Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star, then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so very much, Bella, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's workshop. And today's workshop is with the where it's collaborative, a partnership with the Colorectal Cancer Alliance and Cancer Care. And the title of today's program is Advances in the Treatment of Colorectal Cancer. And today's program is supported by Taiho Oncology, Inc. and Takeda Oncology. And I really want to thank them for their support of today's program. Now, before I introduce our speakers, there's a couple of things I'd like to do. First of all, we have over 120 participants on the call today. You come from all over the United States, from both urban, rural, suburban, and frontier communities. And we also have international participants from Canada, Iraq, New Zealand, Saudi Arabia, Uganda, and the United Kingdom. So this is truly a global call as well. And I really want to thank all of you for taking the time to spend on this call to learn more about colorectal cancer, all the advances in the treatment of colorectal cancer. And now it is my pleasure introduce our first speaker, and our first speaker is Dr. Al Benson III, and Dr. Benson is Professor of Medicine, Associate Director for Cooperative Groups, Robert H. Lurie Comprehensive Cancer Center, Northwestern University. And Dr. Benson will be addressing an overview of colorectal cancer, including current standard of care, the increasing number of younger people being diagnosed with colorectal cancer, new treatment approaches, and predicting response to treatment. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Benson.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. It's a pleasure to join everyone. Let's start with overview of colorectal cancer and current standard of care. Colorectal cancer is generally noted to be the third most diagnosed cancer in the world and is a disease that is often referred to as being preventable for people who undergo recommended screening. Screening for the general population should begin at age 45, and it is important to note that screening is important because many people will experience no symptoms and yet with screening are diagnosed with cancer. Currently, about 20% of people have a genetic factor, which is either an inherited syndrome, such as familial adenomatous polyposis, or the more common Lynch syndrome. However, even without a known inherited factor, if a person has a first-generation relative with CRC, then there's about a 3 times risk of developing colorectal cancer among family members. Therefore, it is very important for people to know their family history and discuss such with their healthcare team. Other risk factors for colorectal cancer, including dietary factors such as high fat intake, people with inflammatory bowel disease, diabetes, being overweight, lack of exercise, smoking, and other environmental factors. Currently, there is significant interest in the intestinal microbiome, which has evolved over time, likely related to the processing of food and the type of diet, and is likely contributing to the development of cancers. Study of the microbiome is now an important area of research. It is important that we determine if a person has colon cancer or rectal cancer, since the treatment approaches are quite different. For most individuals with stages 1, 2, and 3 colon cancer, surgery is performed, after which those with stage 1 and the majority of stage 2 individuals may be followed under surveillance for 5 years, although follow-up colonoscopies generally every 3 to 5 years would continue. The majority of higher-risk stage 2 and the stage 3 individuals would be offered 3 to 6 months of postoperative chemotherapy, referred to as adjuvant treatment, and then would undergo surveillance. For rectal cancer patients, there has been a transformation in the treatment approach such that individuals with stage 2 and 3 rectal cancer are now offered preoperative or neoadjuvant therapy, which typically consists of both chemotherapy and combined chemotherapy and radiation, although there are individuals who, for whom preoperative chemotherapy alone may be sufficient. And in addition, we now evaluate individuals carefully after neoadjuvant therapy, since some may not have to proceed with surgery, but may be watched very carefully to make sure surgery is not eventually required. This approach is called watch and wait. Stage 1 rectal cancer patients are treated with surgery alone. It is increasingly clear through technology that colorectal tumors are not all the same. Therefore, there is increasing emphasis on evaluating each person's tumor to create a biological profile using tumor from the person's actual colon or rectal cancer, from a metastatic tumor such as from the liver, or from the patient's blood. For colon or rectal individuals with advanced, recurrent, or metastatic disease, we routinely evaluate patients' tumors and/or circulating tumor DNA from the blood for tumor-related genomic or molecular changes that are now linked to specific treatments. I think we'll hear more about this from Dr. Balgan, but briefly, increasingly, this assessment is performed by what is known as next-generation sequencing, or NGS, that can evaluate hundreds of genes within tumor DNA, including relatively rare events such as NTRK fusions, for which, even though rare, there are now specific treatments. The most commonly identified observed changes, including RAS mutations in nearly 50% of individuals, BRAF mutations in about 10% of people, and for those with non-mutated RAS, known as wild type, we also look for HER2 expression. For those with RAS mutations, we know that the anti-EGFR drugs cetuximab and panitumumab will not work as they do for RAS wild type individuals. In the past, there were no specific drugs for those with RAS mutations. However, there are now drugs available for people with certain subtypes of RAS mutations, and clinical trials are continuing for other subtypes. There are specific regimens for people with BRAF mutations and with HER2 expression. One striking area of advancement across many cancer types, including CRC, is research aimed at understanding the role of our immune systems play in the development of cancers, which has led to the development of specific immunotherapeutic drugs. In CRC, the most frequent current use of immunotherapy is for patients who have alterations in the DNA mismatch repair pathway. Pathologists now routinely report alterations when evaluating the CRC tumor, and all CRC patients should know their mismatch repair or MSI status. Briefly, microsatellites are short repeating DNA sequences across the human genome. The sequences are very prone to errors, and there are genes that correct these errors. If the tumor has deficient mismatch repair proteins or microsatellite instability, errors are not corrected and tumors develop. Mismatch repair genes can be altered through germline or inherited mutations or by non-inherited loss of expression. 15% of CRC tumors are deficient mismatch repair, and most of these are sporadic or non-inherited. Most of these patients will have earlier stage disease and do very well after surgery. However, 5% of cases have advanced disease. The good news is that for patients deficient mismatch repair, immunotherapeutic agents for those with metastatic disease and has become they approach. Most recent people with deficient mismatch repair rectal tumors have received remarkable responses from immunotherapy and thus far have been able to avoid chemotherapy, radiation, and surgery. We still have much more to understand about the use of immunotherapy, and such continues an important area of research. Although, as mentioned, the majority of people with deficient mismatch repair tumors do not have in inherited colorectal cancer. It is important for those individuals who have germline testing to make sure they do not have an inherited type of tumor syndrome, in particular, Lynch syndrome. In addition, people with inherited cancers differ in terms of surgical consideration, type of surveillance after treatment is complete, and the need to test family members, since those who are positive by testing need genetic counseling and appropriate screening. To move on to the number of younger people being diagnosed now, since the 1990s, the incidence of colon and rectal cancers has been steadily increasing among adults younger than age 50. The rise of early onset colorectal cancer is both puzzling and alarming, since in older adults, the incidence has been decreased, likely because of increased rates of screening and decreased cigarette smoking. This increase has been seen particularly in Alaska Native, American Indian, and white people, although it should also be noted that Black individuals are still more likely to get colorectal cancer at a young age than white people. We do not know the cause of this rising cancer among young adults, although there are potential factors such as rising obesity, physical inactivity, and smoking. It should also be noted that only 10 to 20% of those with early onset colorectal cancers have an inherited risk such as Lynch syndrome. There are a number of factors that are being investigated, including diet, the bacteria in the intestines, which encompass the microbiome, which is, by the way, intricately linked to our immune systems and inflammation. There are bacteria that have already been identified that appear to contribute to the development of colorectal cancer. The intestinal bacteria are affected by the food and chemicals we eat, drink, and breathe, and also can be affected by exercise and some drugs such as antibiotics that are also used in our food sources. Thus far, outside of identifying younger people with an inherited risk, we do not have ability to identify those who might carry increased risk of cancer, and therefore, it is difficult to design a screening program without such understanding. In terms of new treatment approaches, I've already mentioned some of the newer agents, including the use of immunotherapeutics, which have evolved over recent time. Other approaches under investigation include those who have metastatic disease confined to the liver and may be liver transplant candidates. Thus far, small numbers of individuals have undergone this type of intervention, and therefore there is more to be learned as to who might be the best individual to undergo such a procedure. The recommendation for transplantation therefore requires extremely careful patient selection and extensive multidisciplinary team review, and for the individual, the understanding that risk of recurrence, including metastases outside the liver, is a significant risk, and there may or may not be opportunities to successfully treat recurrence. Another area of active research is the use of circulating tumor DNA as obtained from the blood to determine use of chemotherapy for those with surgically resected stage 2 colon cancer at high risk for recurrence is one example. By identifying circulating tumor DNA, there is the potential to identify potential treatment targets, but also the ability to evaluate patients to see who might be most likely to recur from the original colorectal cancer, and if treatment is effective for those who have presence of circulating tumor DNA after surgery. One other development is a fairly consistent body of work that has shown that people with a tumor PIK3CA mutation have improved outcomes when they take low-dose aspirin at least for 3 years after surgery. In terms of predicting response to treatment, one of the challenges in developing strategies for patients with colorectal cancer is to predict which individuals are most likely to benefit from a treatment. We have made progress, and I have given examples, including those with deficient mismatch repair, who are most likely to benefit from immunotherapy, and those with RAS wild-type tumors, who are most likely to benefit from cetuximab or panitumumab. Even in those circumstances, however, we cannot absolutely predict that each individual will in fact respond to these interventions, although they would be more likely to do so. The use of circulating tumor DNA is currently a prognostic factor, and for those who are positive, treatment is generally recommended. However, we cannot predict whether treatment, such as chemotherapy, will be effective. Nonetheless, research continues in this important area. This concludes my remarks, which represent a condensed summary of a very extensive topic. We have learned very much from clinical trials and laboratory research, and it is so important that these efforts continue and with even more funding to answer the many questions that remain. Thanks, and back to you, Dr. Mesner.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Benson. That was just a stellar presentation, and because you're the first speaker, you've really set the stage for today's program, so lots of information, and there'll be lots of questions, I'm sure, for you during the Q&A as well. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Thien Folo Balogun, and Dr. Balogun is Assistant Attending Physician, Gastrointestinal Oncology, Department of Medicine, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And Dr. Balogun will be addressing staging and biomarker testing, the role of targeted cancer therapies, clinical trial updates, how research contributes to treatment options, preventing and managing treatment side effects, symptoms, discomfort, and pain, and guidelines to prepare for telehealth, telemedicine appointments, including technology, prepared list of questions, quality of life concerns, follow-up appointments, and discussion of open notes. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Balogun.
Thank you very much, Dr. Mesner, and it is an honor to be on the call today. Very nice to follow Dr. Benson as he clearly laid out the overview of colorectal cancer. So some of the things, a lot of what I will be talking about refers back to what Dr. Benson has touched on. So what first is, what is staging? And staging is essentially a means by which we classify colorectal cancer into different levels, tells us how advanced the cancer is. And it's very important in terms of how it directs treatment and management, and also how aggressive it is could be a reflection of how much more aggressive our treatment options can be. There are typically four stages, stage 1, 2, 3, and 4. Stage 4 is also known as metastatic disease. This is when the cancer has left where it initially started, in the colorectal, so the colon or the rectum, and has traveled to distant regions. So maybe it has traveled to the liver or the abdomen or the parts of the abdomen or even the lungs. Stage 1 to 3 are localized and just expressing different levels of how involved it is in the local area, but it has not traveled far. And as Dr. Benson had mentioned, the treatment we would use for the early stages typically involves surgery along with, in most cases, chemotherapy, but surgery plays less of a role, not a 0% role, but less of a role in stage 4 metastatic disease. Now, what is a biomarker? So a biomarker really can be defined as some objective measure that gives us a sense of normal or abnormal states of the body in biology. And in cancer specifically, this serves many important roles. Biomarkers are something that, if I give a few examples, we'll realize that we're familiar with. Some non-cancer biomarkers include A1C, hemoglobin A1C, which is used to determine diabetes. Blood pressure is also a biomarker. So these are things, PSA, for prostate cancer. These are all things that give us a sense of how the body is doing. In cancer, some more examples, one that Dr. Benson mentioned and is very important in colorectal cancer, is the mismatch repair or MSI status. This is important because it does tell us whether the cancer, the colorectal cancer, is likely to respond to immunotherapy. Now, immunotherapy, the way I think of it is, chemotherapy is a toxin that goes in there, and when you get the chemotherapy, it attacks the cancer cells. The immunotherapy does not directly attack the cancer cells, but it tells your body's immune system that protects you from infections. It makes it more aggressive, ramps it up so it goes to attack the cancer. And we know that some colorectal cancers are susceptible to being revved up in the immune system. Excuse me. Now, some other examples of biomarkers in colorectal cancer include HER2, NTRK, as Dr. Benson mentioned, and also lots of other genetics, several other genetic mutations. And this we typically test for, identify through the NGS, Next Generation Sequencing, which looks at the genetic profile, which I like to describe of as the blueprint for the cancer. It's a genetic profile of the whole tumor. Identifying different mutations and errors in there can help us better understand the tumor, the cancer, but also can guide treatment. Now, how can this help, or how can this help with treatment? The first one I initially talked about, the mismatch repair status, or the MSI status. It can tell us, even in localized cancers, the early stage cancers, whether or not someone would benefit from chemotherapy or no treatment at all after surgery. So that makes a difference, and that's why it's performed on every colorectal cancer. It should be known, because it can determine whether or not chemotherapy would be of any benefit to you in the early stage cancers. And we have shown that in the later stage cancers, the more advanced cancers, those tumors that have mismatch repair deficiency will do at least twice as well as those that on immunotherapy versus on chemotherapy. So knowing that is very important to predicting and guiding our treatment options. And nowadays, I like to say that there are not any new chemotherapy regimens being made or created or designed. Drugs that are being designed now are what we call precision or targeted therapy. So they identify specific features, which are these biomarkers of the tumor, of the cancer, and then they target that. So in order to know whether a targeted therapy that already exists or that's coming up could be relevant, it's important to know the biomarkers, what genetics exist in this tumor. So it is becoming more widespread that anyone diagnosed with colorectal cancer, especially in the advanced stages, should be having this genetic testing, NGS, in order to more efficiently guide their treatments. And we do know that when patients are treated based on or guided by these biomarkers, this genetic testing, they do better than when we don't use it. Now, in terms of the next topic of clinical trial updates, and how research can contribute to treatment options, we have come a long way and doing much better with reducing the incidence overall of colorectal cancer and also the number of people that die from it each year. Granted, we're seeing more people arise in the number of young individuals that are diagnosed with colorectal cancer, but overall the numbers are going down. However, we still have more than 150,000 people diagnosed every year in the United States, and we still have more than 50,000 people dying every year. It's obvious that we have room to improve. Now, what clinical trials do is when we identify potential drugs that show promise, whether it's promise in the lab, the clinical trial allows us to advance it and get it to people. The overall clinical trials really do help us develop better ways of identifying colorectal cancer, diagnosing it, better ways of preventing it, and treating it. Many new drugs, targeted therapies, and immunotherapies are being currently developed and looked at. Different ways by which we screen for colorectal cancer are also being looked at, and with a recent approval of a blood-based method of screening for colorectal cancer with the goal of improving how effective we are at screening for this disease before it actually becomes a cancer. Now, the a lot of these precision or targeted drugs, we tend to see them more in the advanced cancer space when it's metastatic cancer, and over time comes into the earlier phase and earlier state. And one of the ways, an example of how this is being reflected, is in recent studies that are showing that when we give immunotherapy to patients with rectal cancer that have early disease, mismatch repair deficient, we recently have been seeing trials show us that they get cure in their cancer. A very high percentage of them get cure, really higher than what we used to see when we gave chemotherapy, surgery, and immunotherapy all combined. Now, granted, that's a small percentage of patients that have the mismatch repair deficient rectal cancer, but that's an example of how clinical trials are advancing our how we manage this disease with less toxicity, less side effects, and more better benefits and ability to cure the cancer. Now, when we get treated, when we get treated with colorectal cancer, especially with chemotherapy, there's several side effects, symptoms that we come about. And this dovetails into the next topic, which is preventing and managing the treatment side effects. It's essential to emphasize that medications that manage symptoms are essential. Some of these symptoms, common side effects of these drugs include nausea, neuropathy, which is a numbness, tingling, progressing to pain in the hands and feet, diarrhea, constipation, peeling and drying of the skin or a burning sensation of the skin, especially in the palms and the feet, pain and discomfort in several parts. Now, while there are medicines that can be used to treat this, understandably, many of us don't like to take additional medicines we don't have to. But it's important to remember that these symptoms, getting them under control, would help your overall ability to tolerate the treatment for the cancer and also improve your quality of life during treatment. And in most cases, many of these treatments are just needed, these symptomatic treatments are needed just during the time when we're actually undergoing treatments with the chemotherapy. Now, for the last section about guidelines to prepare for telehealth and telemedicine appointments, these are, fortunately, we're able to do more of these telehealth visits now, and it provides convenience. There are advantages to it and the potential disadvantages. So the goal is to try to maximize the advantages and minimize the downsides to it. It's important to give time beforehand to prepare for the visit. Take some time to think about what you want to get out of the visit. Write down questions that you have. If you have others who want to join you, they can join. It's more convenient for this to happen with the telemedicine. And I always like to say that the more people there, the better, because when you get so much information when you speak to the doctors, and it's in most cases we cannot take in or absorb all that information. But when you have several people on the call with you, you're all taking different bits and pieces of it and come back together, circle back together, and put it all together, having the whole information. Now, ensure beforehand that you sign on and check your device requirements, that it works for the telehealth visits, so that when the actual visit comes up, you're not fumbling away most of the time trying to go through resolve the technical difficulties, and as such become rushed in the time you have. Ensure you're in a good place with good internet access. Less noisy or quiet would be ideal. And also set time aside. If the visit is at 3 o'clock, you don't want to schedule something at 3:15 or 3:30. Just in case the visit happens a little later, you don't want to feel rushed. And remember, no question is silly or too small. Too often, I've had patients ask about if they will have loss of their hair and say, oh, it's not a serious thing. But I think every question you have is serious and it's legitimate, even if you think it may not be. It could be it's something that's important. And lastly, do not forget to ask about supported non-medical resources that may be available. Very often, the social worker can help with these, with providing weather resources of what could be available. And some examples include transportation assistance, coping, it's a big diagnosis, and managing it for the patient and their family, and also things like how to discuss the diagnosis with children. Thank you very much for this opportunity to discuss, and I look forward to the Q&A session.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Valku. That was just a wonderful presentation, just stellar, with a great deal of information and a lot of detailed information that's incredibly helpful to our participants. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well, so thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you. And our next speaker is Ms. Diana Bearden, and Ms. Bearden is an oncology dietitian with the Michael E. DeBakey VA Medical Center, and she'll be addressing the role of the oncology dietitian and nutrition and hydration concerns and tips. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Bearden.
Thank you so much, Carolyn. I'm excited to be part of today's presentation. Nutrition and hydration are fundamental as part of your treatment plan. Without adequate nutrition and hydration, your body won't function properly. Throughout your treatment journey, there may be some changes to your diet based on your unique needs, the treatment you receive, and your response to the treatment. Some possible side effects, just a few to name, are decreased appetite, abdominal bloating, diarrhea, constipation, nausea, maybe some taste changes. The dietitian on your healthcare team can provide you your individual calorie, protein, and fluid needs and information on diet modifications to help you through each stage of treatment. Each person responds differently to treatment. We need you to communicate changes as you're experiencing them so we can help you as quickly as possible. The goal is to meet your nutrition goals and avoid significant weight loss during your treatment process. Weight loss can result in a loss of lean muscle mass, and it can impact your immune function. It can make weakness more prevalent. It can even increase your risk of falls. So please reach out to us. The sooner we jump on issues that you're challenged with, the sooner we can help you. Even if you're overweight, you can still become malnourished. So don't think weight is an indicator independently of your nutrition status. If you're struggling with any foods or struggling with certain times of the day, please write that down. Communicate that with your healthcare team. That'll help us help you better. There are medications to assist with some of the side effects I've mentioned. Make sure you feel comfortable in how to take them and when to take them. Even review them with your healthcare team to make sure you heard them correctly and that you documented down the directions they provided you. Medications are very effective in helping side effects, so being able to use them properly can really make a difference. Hydration sometimes is left off the list. We're so focused on eating and weight and all of those things, but dehydration is actually pretty powerful. It can amplify a lot of the symptoms that I talked about. And even make you feel dizzy and lightheaded. Fluids are anything that are liquid at room temperature, so things like water, milk, juice, sports drinks. A general guideline is most people need between 8 and 10 8-ounce glasses of fluid a day. But treatments such as radiation and other things may alter your fluid needs. So, again, knowing your healthcare team and understanding your unique needs is really the most important thing. In closing, there are several members of the healthcare team know how to reach us, know how to reach us quickly, and we're very happy to help and respond. That's what we're here for. So in closing, I want to thank y'all for letting me be part of today's presentation. I'm going to hand the line back over to Carolyn.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Bearden. That was just a wonderful presentation with lots of information on diet and hydration and fluids. So thank you so much. And our next speaker is Ms. Angel Russell, and she is VP of Mission Impact and Partnerships, Colorectal Cancer Alliance. And Ms. Russell will be addressing the three programs and services of the Colorectal Cancer Alliance and the Patient and Family Support Helpline. She'll give you that number and also their website as well. So it's my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Russell.
Thank you so much. On behalf of our CEO, Michael Sapienza, and the entire Alliance staff, I want to say thank you so much to the Cancer Care team for having us partner on this incredible and necessary call. I wanted to tell a story about my friend Shannon to kind of highlight what services are available at the Colorectal Cancer Alliance. 8 years ago, Shannon, who was my best friend, was diagnosed with colon cancer at the age of 31. She was young and full of joy, and she had only been married for a few months to the love of her life, and she worked in a really fun entertainment industry role. Sadly, she passed away 2 years later at the age of 33, but it was really the way that she journeyed through colorectal cancer that left a lot to be desired. Shannon was young, and she didn't know anyone else her age with colon cancer. She absolutely would have benefited from the Alliance's Young Onset Affinity Group, which brings together people who have been diagnosed who are under the age of 50 to really support one another in their journeys. She could have also joined our Blue Hope Nation Facebook group, which has over 13,000 patients, families, and caregivers who support one another and really provide critical insight into the cancer journey so people don't feel alone. Shannon lived in Los Angeles and had an incredible medical team, but she could have really benefited from the Alliance's live navigation support. We have certified live and clinical navigators to help patients with treatment options and, you know, to help them get through and understand the availability of clinical trials and biomarker testing to really drill down the best pathway for their treatment. She would have also had access to all of our resource guides, which list both national and local resources from everything from holistic therapies to hair salons, which are also needed. Shannon loved being around people, and she gave the best hugs. I miss those every day. And she would have definitely benefited from our annual AllyCon conference, which is specific for patients, families, and caregivers. And we bring people together to understand what their resources are and really provide that extra push in their journey. And finally, Shannon was hit with this disease out of nowhere and experienced financial difficulties as a result. She would have surely benefited from our financial support, which provides help to those who need assistance with everyday bills or to keep food on the table. So I tell Shannon's story not only to honor her life, I try to say her name as much as I can, but to really highlight the importance of navigation in cancer care. The Colorectal Cancer Alliance, we're really dedicated to not only helping to remove barriers to screening, but also to help people live better with cancer. All of the resources that I mentioned, and there's so much more, from our resource guides to our live navigation support, they are available in our free patient support platform called BlueHQ, and the website is bluehq.com. I want to also mention that the Alliance has just released a $100 million RFP for our Project Cure CRC, which is the largest ever philanthropic investment in colorectal cancer research, with the goal of expediting cancer research to a curable science. We have already awarded $10 million in research awards and will continue to award more. For more information on this RFP, you can visit our website at colorectalcancer.org. The Alliance has so many resources available for screening, including the colonoscopy fund for free colonoscopies and for fit kits. We also have a free screening quiz at quiz.getscreened.org, which gives a personalized screening recommendation. That quiz is available in both English and Spanish. And we have live screening navigators who are on standby to help remove any access barriers to screening. Again, thank you so much to Cancer Care for partnering with the Alliance on today. We look forward to working with each of you around the world to really help meet our mission to end this disease in our lifetime. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Angel, for that really wonderful presentation and also for telling the story of your very good friend, Shannon. so that everyone could have a better understanding of all the resources available from the Colon Cancer Alliance. So thank you so much. I'm just going to say a few words about Cancer Care Services. Cancer Care is a national organization providing free programs and services to people throughout the United States. We have a hopeline, 800-813-4673, which people can call. Usually an oncology social worker answers the phone. They're in queue, so they basically, there's no wait time to speak to someone. And they usually have a particular question that they're going to ask, whether it be either help with financial assistance or co-payment assistance or counseling services. So let me go over what some, I'm going to review some of the services. So some of the services include, of course, co-payment, financial assistance, and practical assistance. We also offer help with online support groups. And those are for every type of cancer, including colorectal cancer, and also for caregivers, family members, young adults, older adults, LGBT community. So we do offer services to all different communities. We also have a website, www.cancercare.org, and on the website you'll be able to see all of the services that we offer. And I should let you know that we're going to provide to all of you the resources and phone numbers that were given out during the program today. So you, and even some additional ones, you'll all be getting a Survey Monkey after the program. And you'll also be getting, of course, all the resources that we've mentioned. We're moving right on to the Q&A, and I'm going to ask Bella to explain to you how to queue up and ask questions.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
Excellent. Thank you. This will be the first question. GI/GU cancers are prevalent in my family, both maternally and paternally. Should I restrict certain food drinks from my diet just to be safe and not increase my risks? Dr. Benson, if you could address that question.
Well, the first thing I would say is if there's a history of the family, I would discuss with your healthcare team whether to make an appointment with a genetic counselor to review what your risk is, because not only can they identify if you are at a particular risk, but if you are, they can give you important information about what you need to do in terms of screening and other ways to reduce your risk. Currently, in terms of diet, which certainly has been associated with a number of different cancers, we are really urging people to follow often the guidelines of a Mediterranean diet, which many have viewed as quite healthy. But in essence, it's trying to reduce the amount of processed foods that you eat. And unfortunately, many of our foods are heavily processed, to focus a great deal on fresh fruits and vegetables. I would also say that frozen vegetables are very, very healthy and a good source of nutrition. And many of our vegetables have cancer-preventing properties. And also to decrease the amount of fat, the amount of red meat, to also focus on whole grains, for example, and avoiding really sugary foods, including sugary soft drinks. And these are some of the basic recommendations that are being made across the board, particularly with the rise of diabetes and obesity in the U.S. and in fact, in many other parts of the world, and there's a great deal of concern and why we hope people can adjust their diets.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you. A question for Dr. Balogun. Is it possible for cancer to develop in place of where a polyp was removed?
So that's a very good question. When a polyp is totally removed, fully removed, it won't be the we wouldn't expect cancer to develop in that place. In some cases, when the polyp is removed, not all of it is removed. It may be a polyp that's not so easy, doesn't just hang out like a stalk that you clip. They may have to, what we discuss is what we call piecemeal. They may have to just pull off little parts of it. Whatever is residual there, if it's not, if we don't go back in to take it all fully out, that can progress to cancer. So the simple answer is yes, it can, but not if we're able to successfully take out all the polyps. In colonoscopies, they usually report if they were able to take out all the polyp or not in its entirety.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Thank you. For Dr. Benson, my doctor found inflammatory polyps during my most recent colonoscopy. What does this mean, and will I need to have colonoscopies more often?
Well, it's an important question. So, first of all, as I've mentioned, it's important to know your family history. Are you at risk for an inherited cancer? And if that is a concern, germline testing should be done because the screening recommendations for people with inherited cancers is different than for the general population. And of course, most people don't have inherited cancers, but it's important to know. So it is critical to know what is seen under the microscope, how many polyps there might have been present. So it's an important discussion with the gastroenterologist. Some people would need a repeat in 1 year, depending on how the procedure went. For many people, repeating the colonoscopy in 3 years or in 5 years would be appropriate. But if it's, for example, a tubular adenoma, that's the type of polyp that can transform into a cancer, and by removing such a polyp, that alleviates the risk, at least for that polyp. But it's a really important discussion to have. But for many people who have a polyp removed, they can wait 3 or even 5 years. But it's an important review with the gastroenterologist.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And a question for Dr. Balogun. My mother had colon cancer. I have regular colonoscopies. 2 years ago, I lost half my colon from a volvulus. Does having only half a colon increase my risk of colon cancer?
No, it doesn't increase your risk of colon cancer. Just the fact that there's half a colon left. If anything, because there's less colon, there's less bowel to have cancer. So if anything, it may be less. It is important that it's interesting that you do mention that your mother had colon cancer. That's important to know with family history, and that could potentially guide and probably is already doing that, the frequency or the time when you started doing your colonoscopies. But having lost some of the colon or having a shorter colon does not increase the risk of colon cancer.
Thank you so much, Dr. Balogun. And the question for Dr. Benson, what is the validity of tumor marker CEA in suspicious tumor recurrence?
So CEA is one of the tests. It is viewed as a marker associated with colorectal cancer, although not exclusively. Any adenocarcinoma, and adenocarcinomas are the most common type of tumor cell, can produce CEA. But The standard of practice is to obtain the CEA prior to surgery and then during surveillance. So if a CEA marker is changing, if it's increasing, that warrants discussion and thorough review to determine when to repeat, for example, CT scans, and also to make sure people are up to date with their colonoscopy, and also to make sure other screenings have been done, such as in women, routine mammographies and so forth. But if it is rising, there are other reasons the CEA can rise. For example, any inflammation, it can rise from cigarette smoking, for example. But if it is rising, that requires review and making sure that the surveillance strategy is adhered to on a regular basis.
Thank you so much, Dr. Benson. And Dr. Balogun, question from one of our participants. I feel so tired after my cancer treatments. I don't remember being so exhausted in my life. Is there anything I can do about this?
Sorry to hear that. Chemotherapy does, I like to think it does, I'll say it asks a lot of the body. So it's a burden on the body. And that's, you know, people feel tired in general after chemotherapy. Just one of the things that can really help that is nutrition. So trying to get in as much food and calories as possible, because your body uses that to build itself back up and be stronger to tolerate the treatment. This should ideally happen throughout the whole time, because right after chemotherapy you may feel too tired to eat or have nausea, but even when you start to feel better, you should be eating as much as you can to build up your reserves. That's really the thing that helps the most. Also understanding that at least while getting the chemotherapy, there's a new baseline where you should be able to go about your daily activities, but you just may not have enough energy to do things like you used to before. So listening to your body and not pushing it too much, resting when you need to. And really, if in spite of all these things, if it does feel pretty significant and the tiredness and the fatigue is extended, then it could be an indication that you need a lower dose. While we typically start around the same dose, depending on height and weight for everyone, we make adjustments to the dose because we understand every person is a unique individual. So if it's pretty bad, it could be a sign that some of the doses need to be reduced.
Excellent. Thank you so much. That's excellent. Thank you. For Dr. Benson, I read about regular use of aspirin or aspirin-like drugs reduces risk of polyps and colon cancer. Can you explain more?
Yes. So drugs like aspirin and, in addition, other non-steroidals such as celecoxib have been the subject of a great deal of study. These are anti-inflammatory drugs, and as such, have been helpful in reducing polyps for individuals with polyp syndromes. And also in clinical trials for people who have had colorectal cancer and then undergoing surveillance, there's now information that these agents may help reduce the risk of recurrence. And so I did mention that there's a particular mutation called the PIK3CA mutation, which can be observed in tumors. And that group appears to benefit from low-dose aspirin given for, at least from what we know by trials, for 3 years after surgery. So it is worth talking about use of aspirin with your doctor. aspirin can cause side effects, including bleeding. So it's important to review with your doctor if there are any particular risks for taking aspirin. But aspirin does appear to be beneficial. And currently now we're beginning to test people, for example, the PIK3CA mutation. That mutation may not be as important for the use of a drug, celecoxib, but still study.
Excellent. Thank you so much. I want to thank our participants, just wonderful questions. I want to thank our speakers for just giving such great presentations and answering these wonderful questions. And I want to ask our speakers just to leave us with a one-minute takeaway from today's program. So I'm going to start with Dr. Benson.
So I would say, particularly because younger people now have higher incidence, although of course it's still fairly rare, but higher incidence, do not ignore symptoms. So if you're developing more chronic abdominal symptoms, and certainly if you're having rectal bleeding, do not ignore that. Also, to make sure you know your family history well. And in addition, for all other individuals to adhere to cancer screening guidelines, including colorectal cancer screening guidelines, because now routinely for the general population, screening should begin at age 45.
Thank you so much. And Dr. Balagoon?
I want to reemphasize one of the things that Dr. Benson mentioned, which is family history, knowing family history, discuss what people had, because that can help with properly screening. But the other part, it really is when dealing with pancreatic cancer treatment management, to always ask what role genetic testing can play, because the newer drugs, newer treatments, better understanding of the disease is really being tied to precision oncology, personalized medicine now, and genetic testing is integral to that.
Excellent. Thank you. And Ms. Russell, your takeaway?
Yes, absolutely. First, thank you so much again for having us. The takeaway would be that patients don't have to fight this disease alone. If you are a patient or a caregiver or a family member, you can connect with others who've been on your journey. You can join support groups, Facebook groups, connect with navigators, or just ask questions to anyone who will listen. And finally, just remember to take care of yourself. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I want to thank again all of our speakers and our participants. Although we've done this program before. Oh, yes?
I'd like to. Can I just make one plea that all of our advances have come from research, and it's a plea to really support our research efforts, including the necessary funding to make sure our research programs are robust and continue.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Benson. That's such an important point. Please advocate for the continuation of the very robust clinical trials that we've seen over the years. Remember, the clinical trials of today are the treatment of tomorrow. So all the advances are based on clinical trials and also patients' willingness to participate in trials. I realize we did not get to everyone's question, so I just wanted to comment on that. For those of you who got to ask a question, please take your question back to Treating Healthcare Team because they know you the best, and they actually know everything about you. They have your medical records in front of them, and you've learned a lot on today's program, so you'll take your questions back to Treating Healthcare Team. And for those of you who are in queue and didn't get to ask your question, take your question to your healthcare team also. And remember, you've learned a lot, so you'll take that question and you'll ask the question of your healthcare team. And be sure to ask questions of your healthcare team regularly. Also, it's very important for all of you to know how to reach the healthcare team evenings, weekends, and holidays. It seems that during the day you usually can reach your healthcare team, but sometimes you don't know what to do when something happens on evenings, weekends, and holidays. So be sure you check with your healthcare team how to reach them on those at those times. Also, I think I just want to reiterate that you're not alone, that you do have the Colon Cancer Alliance, you have Cancer Care, and many other organizations that are out there to help you. So please recognize that you do not have to cope with this by yourselves. Again, I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.